Good evening, everybody. My name is Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. I didn't think the reading was too long. In fact, it could have gone on a little bit more for us. My sobriety date is November 22nd, 2006. I have a sponsor, and I use my sponsor as much as possible. I need to use a sponsor. And I have the honor to sponsor other men, and that truly is a privilege and an honor. I didn't think that when I first came into these rooms. In fact, when my first sponsor told me that the deal was that I would pass this on to somebody else, I said yes, but in my heart of hearts, I thought, there ain't no way. I don't have time to be fooling with somebody else. I got enough problems of my own to be worrying about what other people's problems are. But that is where all the magic is. You know, there's just, I can't describe it. People that sponsor other people, they know exactly what I'm talking about. But to sit with somebody and work with that individual, and especially as most of us come in here, we're broken. We're not guiding lights. We're usually broken. And so usually the guys that come to me, they're broken in one fashion or another. And some of them, you know, stick around. Others don't, and that's okay. I get to stay sober. But every now and then, you know, one will stick in there, and to watch the light go on, to see the difference, to see the life change, there just isn't anything better than that. I can't emphasize that enough. And it's miles from where I was when I first came in here. I want to thank Sam for asking me. Thank you all for showing up on this gorgeous Sunday afternoon. And I can't help but thank Billy, too, for asking me, because I know that he had a part in it. And the reason why I know that is because at the last conference we were at in Richmond, the new pair of glasses, he said, Tom, we got to get you back up there. And, you know, that to me is a sign that AA works. And what I mean by that is that, you know, it wasn't too long ago that you know, if you made the mistake of asking me to come, you know, to something of importance to you, you didn't make the same mistake twice. Because I wasn't the type of person that you wanted to see around a second time once you got a dose of me the first time around. And the fact that Billy was kind enough to ask me to come forward is an indication that, you know, that this program does work. You know, either that or Billy just burned off too many brain cells during his drinking, and he forgot what it was like first time. I don't know, one of those two. And I want to thank Kelly, too, for riding with me. We came up from Richmond, and I always like having somebody with me in a car when I've got to drive a long way and to talk, because if I don't, I'm going to get up in my head and I'm going to think about exactly how to, you know, say this, and I'm going to rehearse it in my head, and then I get up here and it just all falls to pieces anyway. And so Kelly did me a great service by keeping me occupied. Although Billy did say, well, you rode up with Kelly. Do you need some time off to yourself to get ready? My sponsor, he whenever I'm going to speak, he tells me two things. He says, you know, don't lie and tell the truth. And he knows exactly what he's dealing with. My first wife, she would tell you, she'd say, you got to listen carefully to Tom. You know, he may not exactly lie to you, but you got to listen carefully to what he says, and then you got to follow up with questions. And I give you a prime example. When I first came into AA, after I was here about 3 or 4 months and had some about 3 or 4 months of sobriety, I did what many of us do. I decided that everybody was waking me, including myself, was making way too much of this thing, and I decided to test the waters and do a little more experimentation. And I got drunk. I didn't just get drunk. I kept drinking and kept trying to figure out a way to continue my drinking, even though I was coming in the rooms. That was the only thing I was doing right, was I kept coming back. I never did leave AA, but I remember I was about 5 months, and my current wife, she said, asked me if I've been drinking, and I said no. And she said, really? Well, Tom, if today was your 5 month anniversary, could you get up and pick up a chip? And I said, absolutely. And to me, I was not lying, because there, in my mind, I thought that through very quickly. There's 30-day chips, there's 3 month chips, there's 6 month chips. There are no 5 month chips. It's impossible to lie about something that doesn't exist. Anyway, the other thing that I just mentioned this real quickly, my sponsor likes to throw me curves every now and then. The last time I was with him when I spoke, he, just as I was being introduced, we were sitting in the front row and he was sitting right next to me. And just as I was being introduced and I was standing up, he leans over and says, "Don't embarrass me." So tonight, you know, the book gives me very clear instructions that our stories disclose in a general way what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now. And with God's help, And that is so big to me that I can say with God's help, because I walked into these rooms and I had no use for God. And I read in these pages, you know, that we agnostics, and I thought that the chapter was for the smart people that didn't need God, and was somewhat disappointed to find out that it's all about God. In fact, it tells me right early on in the second page that, you know, lack of power is my dilemma, and that the primary purpose of this book is for me to find a way to make that connection with the God of my understanding that will solve my problem. Not that I can solve my problems, but the God of my understanding can solve my problems. And then later on in the amends process, it tells me that the whole point of this thing is to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and the people around me. And I can tell you without hesitation today that the God in my life, the God of my understanding, is the single most important thing in my life. I have no hesitation on that, and it's just a miracle that I can say that, because I was angry and had no purpose and no use for God when I came in. But with God's help, I'm going to do the things that I'm supposed to do. I'm going to try to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And with His help, I'm going to try and do it in a way that I don't lie, that I tell the truth, and God forbid I don't embarrass my sponsor. You know, I don't recollect my first drink, really, because I grew up in a family that it was customary to let the kids have a sip of mom and dad's wine, or dad would, you know, say, "Somebody get me a beer," and we'd all race off to get the beer, and the prize was that you got to have that foam after it was opened. And I don't know why we considered that to be such a prize, because it was the nastiest tasting thing, but it was part of the competition, you know, that we did. But I do remember vividly my first drunk. I filled a knee-high bottle full of bourbon, and I put a Ronco corker in it, and I took off and met up with my friends in the woods where we had built this fort. And I uncorked that thing and took the first big hit off of it, and it took every ounce of energy that I had to keep it down and not have it come right back up. And I passed it around, and everybody else had the same exact response that I did. When it came back around to me, I took another big pull. The second one went down a little bit easier. My friends, they were making the fake pass. And really, for the most part, at 16-ounce bottle, I pretty much finished by myself. Now, I don't even remember to this day how I ended up getting home. I do remember waking up on the sofa in my mom and dad's basement, but I have no recollection to this day how I ever got there. And that, you know, that event right there has significance to me today in two ways. One was that while everybody else in that fort, you know, had enough after the first pull, I proceeded to drink it and the rest of that bottle until it was gone. And that I blacked out and had no recollection of what happened afterwards. I don't even know if I had a good time. And, you know, I woke up and I was sick as I could all be. And I did not have the experience where a lot of speakers talk about, that in spite of the hatchet in the forehead, as Sandy Beach likes to call it, and the puking and everything else, that they couldn't wait to do it again. I did not have that feeling. I couldn't wait not to do that again. I had no interest in ever going down that path ever again. And really, the rest of my upbringing was fairly uneventful. I wasn't a big drinker. I didn't look for every opportunity. But I will tell you this, that any time there was an opportunity to drink, I drank until it was all gone, every single time. I don't recall that I blacked out every single time, but it was always, if there was anything there to be drank, I kept drinking until it was gone, or until I went to sleep, I guess. But at some point in time, I came to the realization that booze, and I think primarily the reason why that I didn't drink is because I saw early on in my early life that booze was getting in the way of things that I wanted to do. I had goals and aspirations in life, and the drinking was preventing me from getting to that. So I didn't really do a whole lot of drinking other than occasional party drinking as I was growing up. At some point in time, my drinking took on much more important proportions. It became a central fact of my life later on in life. And I don't exactly know where I got to the point where I crossed the line. The book talks about that we cross line. And I quizzed my first wife. I said, "Was I a problem drinker? Did you think I was a problem drinker?" And she said, "No, I didn't think you were." And I asked my current wife, "Do you recall when it's?" And she says, "No, I don't. I don't recall when it got to be a problem for you." But we all agree at some point in time I got to the point where I crossed the line. And I do remember the first time that somebody actually looked at me funny in the context of my drinking, and it was my wife came in from, I got a little workshop off of my garage, and she went out to get a screwdriver or something, and she came in and she was holding a half a bottle of Wild Turkey, and she held it up and said, "What was this doing out in your workshop?" And when you corner me and you surprise me, I'm going to try to laugh it off. I'm going to try to make a joke about it. I'm going to try to lie about it, whatever I'm going to do. And I looked at her, and with all the glib that I can muster, I said, "I don't know, but thanks. I've been looking for that everywhere." And the look on her face was not one of amusement. It was one of genuine concern. And I saw that look, and any one of us can probably tell you that they recognize that look in a loved one, looking at us with concern, deep concern about something isn't exactly right here. And I saw that look, and it told me that I needed to do something. And so what I did was I moved to pints, because the pints are smaller to hide. And that worked for a while, until she came home one day and asked me what the empty pint was doing sitting on the tailgate of my truck. And I looked at her, and with all seriousness, I said, "I don't know." Now, the only ones at that point in the house were her, me, the two dogs, and the cat. But, the best I could come up was, "I don't know." Again, she looked at me with a little bit of concern. Not a little bit of concern, serious concern at that point in time. And, That event with the bottle where she came in, that kind of had some importance to me nowadays too. And one is that, honestly, folks, to this day, I have no clue how that half fifth of bottle of Wild Turkey got out of my workshop. I don't know how it got out there. But what's important, more important, is that before anybody was saying anything to me about my drinking, was even suggesting that I had a problem with drinking, I was instinctively hiding booze. For some reason or another, it seemed like a good idea to hide that bottle away out in my workshop. Why, I don't know. Now, the half pints were obvious, or the pints were not a good idea, because all of a sudden she discovered that, and so I wasn't hiding those very well. So I needed to go smaller. Now, it just seemed to me to be stupid to go to half pints. And I don't mean to suggest, if anybody was drinking half pints, that this is just my thought process. I'm not saying that anybody out there was stupid because they were drinking half pints, because the reality is that what I thought was a good idea was to go to mini bottles. And, from a cost-effective standpoint, it's the most expensive way you can possibly drink. But as far as I'm concerned, I drive one of the vehicles I drive is a full, at that point in time, the only thing I drove was a full-size pickup truck. It had a console. I could fill that with mini bottles, and I could drive down the road. I could uncork one, toss it down real quick, out the window it go. Evidence is gone. I don't have to worry about hiding anything. And that all seemed like a perfectly good idea to me. And I thought I was managing my drinking quite well. I thought I was hiding it very well. And I like to say that things were going just fine and that I was drinking. I didn't. In fact, I can tell you that I never lost a job. I never had a DUI. I never spent a day in jail. And when I came into these rooms, I would have told you in all seriousness that I didn't have any serious consequences. And that would have been a flat-out lie. Because about a year before I managed to, actually about a year and a half before I managed to find my way into these rooms, I was standing in my garage with my son, my oldest son at the time. He was 25 years old at the time. He came over for a visit. And we were standing out in the garage doing the thing that we like to do the most, which is debate politics of the day. And his and my ideas have always been on opposite sides of the spectrum. And we were debating. He was sipping a Pepsi or something like that. I was smoking cigarettes and tossing down many bottles. And I caught him in a logical corner that he couldn't get out of. And he knew I had him. And he swung his hand in frustration. And something about that movement, that sudden movement on his part, set me off. I don't know why. To this day, I have no idea. But I just grabbed him by the shirt. I shoved him across the garage. I slammed him into the garage door wall. And I was up into his face, seething with absolute anger. Why? I have no idea. And what he was looking back at was not his dad. And the reason why I know that is because he was trying to reach his dad. He was saying, "Dad, Dad, it's me. It's me." He knew that something wasn't right there. And I don't know exactly what it was, but something made me break the hold. And, you know, this would have been a perfect time to beg forgiveness, to tell him how sorry I was, to ask if he was okay. And instead, I told him to get the F out. And he bowed his head, he picked up his things, and he walked to his car, and he drove away. And I didn't see or hear from him for about 15 months after that. He didn't want anything to do with me. He wouldn't take my phone calls. He wouldn't return a phone call. He wouldn't respond to my emails. Nothing. And I came to find out later that he was in fear of his life that night. He thought that I was going to kill him because he was looking back at this monster. In fact, it was, you know, when he finally broke the ice, when I finally got into AA and I started trying to do something, the word got to him, and he called me one night. And I was driving down the road, and I just pulled the phone out. I didn't look to see who it was. I just answered it. And his voice comes over and says, "Hey, how you doing?" And I said, "Great, how you doing?" He said, "I'm doing okay. What's going on?" And I said, "Who is this?" He says, "Is this your son, Justin?" I didn't recognize his voice. It had changed that much, and maybe, I don't know what happened, but I didn't recognize my own son's voice. My daughter, she was 2 years younger. She was 22 at the time. She wasn't staying away from me. She wasn't avoiding my phone calls. Well, I take that back. She was staying away from me. If I asked her to come over, she would. If I called her, she took the phone call. And so she wasn't abandoning me. But one of the things that she was telling my wife, her stepmother, was she was asking her questions. She was saying, "Why are you staying with him? He's my dad, and I love him, but he treats you like dirt. Why are you staying with him?" And she was listening. I found this out later, too. She was begging me to do something. She was suggesting left and right. I finally got tired of it. I asked her, I said, "What do you suggest?" And she said, "How about AA?" And I said, "No, I didn't even know what AA was. I mean, I heard the name, but I had no clue what it was. But I just said, no, I can't go to AA." She says, "I don't understand. Why can't you go to AA? Why can't you try that?" And I gave her some excuse. What was going into my head was, I know that it involves groups. It probably has a group hug involved somewhere. I don't know. I don't do groups. I don't do people. I like to sit on the back on my deck with my bottle of Wild Turkey and my two dogs and just drink without being bothered by anybody. I don't want to be around people, which was just as well because nobody really wanted to be around me. I would have told you that I had no use for people there, but the reality was is that people had no use for me. I have a son that didn't want anything to do with me. I had a daughter that was kind of staying her distance. She was telling my wife that she ought to get out. And the people that I work with, you know, they were dealing with me at arm's length. The people that my direct reports, they're in the office next door to me, and they're communicating with me with email instead of having to come into my office to face me. And I got no friends. So, you know, that's where my life was about that point in time. Well, one day my wife, you know, she was getting concerned. She was trying everything. She was doing everything that she could think of to try to help me. And one morning when we were both heading out to work, I was about ready to head out the door. I was head out the door before her, and she says, "Do you have a minute?" I said, "Sure." And she sets me down, and with a very kind, very loving voice, she looks at me and says, "Tom, I love you with all my heart. There's anybody else I'd rather be with. I don't want to be with anybody else. I want to grow old with you. I want to spend the rest of my life with you. But you're killing yourself, and I can't sit here and watch it anymore. And this Saturday, you and I are going to sit down, and we're going to settle up, and I'm going. I've already made arrangements. I'm leaving. I hope you'll get better. I hope you'll do something. For your sake, for your kids' sake, for everybody's sake, I have to be around you. I hope you'll do something. But I can't sit here and watch you kill yourself." That was a wake-up call. And what went through my head was absolute rage, followed by, "Good, now I can drink in peace." And I didn't say anything to her, and I just said, "Fine." And I got in the truck, and I started driving to work. And I got about halfway to work, and this, you know, I'm sitting there cussing her and, you know, how dare her. And she's just another opportunity, a chance to try to control me and everything else. And I got this voice came in my head. And I know today is the voice of God. It's the first time God talked to me. And the voice says, "Tom, you can't not lose this woman. This is all you've got left. You've got to do something." So I got to work, and I sent her an email, and I told her, I said, "Listen, I will do whatever I can to help you through this process. I'm going to escalate this thing. I'm going to do something." And at that point in time, I was working with a counselor. I called him. I told him. In fact, I say I was working with a counselor. The first thing he asked me when I went and told him all my woes was if I had considered AA. My first thought was he talking to my wife? Where did that idea come from? But I said, "No, I'm coming to you. You're going to help me." And he said, "Okay, well, we'll see how this goes." So 1 week goes by, and I don't drink. 2 weeks go by, and I don't drink. 3 weeks, maybe even four, I don't know. But I start to realize, I start seeing what it is about you people that are making me drink. He's helped me to figure that out. And all of a sudden, I come to realize that it really isn't me. It's you all. And when I say you all, I mean the world. You know, if these people would just do as I told, if they would just stay out of my, if they would just, you know, the book talks about it, then everything would be great, you know. So after about 3 weeks to a month, I start realizing this is really, again, making way too much out of a simple situation. I'll just confine my drinking to weekends. And so I start drinking on Saturdays and Sundays. And after a short period of time, I realize that I'm cheating myself because Friday evenings is really part of the weekend. That's when the weekend starts. Football season, Monday night football is part of the weekend. It progresses. I get to the point where I'm drinking every day except the day that I'm going to see the counselor. And eventually it occurs to me that's stupid. So on the way to see the counselor, I stop at the ABC store and I pick up half a dozen mini bottles so I can have when I come out. After a period of time, it occurs to me that one or two to take the edge off will make this session go a whole lot easier. So I call this guy and I tell him, "It doesn't seem to be working. I'm drinking again. I'm sure that was a big surprise to him. And I tell him that maybe we need to get my doctor involved, some drugs or something like that, but this session all by itself isn't working. He says, no, Tom, I can't do anything for you. Where you need to be is AA. You won't listen to me, but I will send you to a guy named Sherman Masters, who is a foremost expert in substance and alcohol abuse in the Richmond area, probably Central Virginia. And I go to see him, and I tell him my woes and my story, and the first thing he says is, have you considered AA? And I'm looking at him, and I'm saying, no, I'm coming to you, I'm paying you. He says, nah. He says, you're based on what you've just told me, I can pretty much tell you, if you haven't figured out, you're an alcoholic. And if you're an alcoholic, then you need to be in AA. And I said, well, I don't think it's that bad yet. And he says, fine. How about going into the Williamsburg place for 30 days? I said, and he says, I'll work with you there. I said, no, I can't just disappear from my job for 30 days. He says, well, if you won't do that, you won't go into AA, then the only thing I can suggest is an IOP. Well, what's an IOP? It's an intensive outpatient program. What's that? You go 3 nights a week for about 3 hours a night. I don't have to miss work? No, I can do that. So I go to meet with an IOP counselor. I tell her, in all honesty, I answer all of her questions, and we have about a two-hour meeting and tests and everything else. And at the end, she says, well, Tom, if you haven't figured this out, I'm going to tell you, you're an alcoholic. I said, okay, fine. What do we do? She said, well, we can help you, but you have to agree to a few things. I said, okay. She said, you agree to come 3 nights a week and stay the entire session. I said, okay. You agree to show up on time? Okay. You agree to be respectful of the people in the program? Okay. You agree to clean up after yourself? Okay. You agree to go to 3 AA meetings a week? Okay. What? No, I'm coming to you. You're going to help me. No, you don't agree to go to AA. We won't take you. But I'm paying you all this money. I don't care, Tom. We want to see you get well. I didn't realize that she was an 18-year sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous at the time. So I go home, and my wife asks me how it is, and I said, well, I hope you're happy. I have to go to AAA. She looks at me like, yeah. So I go to my first AA meeting. I go to my first IOP session, and it's a Thursday night, and he, after we're going out, I stopped the counselor, and I said, listen, evidently I have to go to 3 AA meetings a week. He said, that's right. I said, I don't know where to go. Where? He said, well, where do you live? And I tell him, he said, you know what? You're in luck. Tomorrow night, there's a group called the Jaywalkers. He says, this would be perfect for you. Now, they have swapped their format, but back then on Friday nights, it was a beginner's meeting from 7 to 7:40, and then they would break for 20 minutes, and they'd come back for a closed, you know, session. And I'm looking at this, and he's telling me, you know, the beginner session, the break, come back for a session, and I'm thinking, this is great. I'm going to kill 2 meetings in 1 night. And I said, so these are 2 meetings I get credit for. He says, no, you get credit for 1. And I said, well, but there's 2 meetings. He says, yeah, but you get credit for 1. And I said, well, what happens if I go to the first meeting and don't go to the second meeting? How many credits do I get? He says, 1. I said, what if I go to the second meeting and I don't go to the first meeting? How many credits do I get? He says, 1. And I get, if I go to both of them, he says, 1. And I'm thinking, does the guy think I'm stupid or what? No, I'm not giving up my whole evening for 1 credit. I mean, I'm not going to do that. I'll go to the beginner's meeting. It's only 40 minutes, and then I'm out of there, and I get my 1 credit. So I come home, and my wife says, well, how was it? And I said, there was so much talk of God. The only thing that was missing was the Salvation Army bell ringer outside. I don't know how I can deal with this. And she says, Tom, I can't believe that somebody as smart as you can't figure out a way to make this work. Well, she knows what buttons to push, but the problem is when I finally get around to getting a sponsor, and my sponsor asked me a few questions, one of them which is, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? I look at him, and I think back to what my wife says about how smart I am making this work, and I said, yes, but I'm going to have to do this in a way that makes sense to me. And so over the next 15, 16 months, I manage to stay sober a month. I get drunk. 2 months, 3 months, get drunk. And it got to be the point where I was just staying drunk. I was just drinking. I was picking up chips. You know, I picked up a 9-month chip. I'm still drinking. You know, the only thing I did right, really, there was only two things that I think I did right during that first year and a half in AA. I came into AA in July of 2005. My sobriety date is November 2006. So from that point on, I didn't have solid sobriety. And there's only two things I was doing right during that whole time. Everything else is, you know. And that one was I was going to meetings every single day. Now, some days I was coming in drunk, but I was going to meetings every day. I didn't leave AA. The second thing was is I kept picking up white chips after I got past that one little thing. And that was important for my long-term sobriety, you know, to I hated that. I hated getting up picking up white chips. But you know what? It saved my bacon. That willingness to Bill talks about in the story, you know, the price had to be paid, you know, destruction of self. And that was one step toward that, you know, lowering myself. But it was necessary. But, you know, it all came crashing down in 2006 of Thanksgiving, before, Tuesday before Thanksgiving. Well, my wife's parents live in Columbia, South Carolina. She was born and raised in South Carolina. So we'd go to South Carolina every year for Thanksgiving. We still do. And I took off. We were going to drive down that Wednesday. And as luck holds, we're going to have to drive separately because of our jobs. And I'm looking forward to this because I can drink all the way down. So I take off on Tuesday. We've got two small dogs. Long hair, they're Shelties, long hair dogs. And I'm going to bathe them before taking them down there with us. And I go home, and I stop at the ABC store, and I get a 12-pack mini bottles, and I put them in my console. Now, I'm not drinking these today. This is for the trip tomorrow. And I get home, and I put the first dog in the truck, and the 2 miles up to the do-it-yourself dog wash. It's a great deal. They got tubs, and you pay them a fee, and they got shampoos. It's really great. And so on the way up there, Shelties take a long time. They take about an hour and a half to do one dog because they're long hair and you got to blow dry them, cut them out, and everything else. And so on the way up, I'm sitting there thinking, you know, just one mini bottle, just to kind of take the edge off of this because it is a tough job to do these two dogs. And on the way there, I mean, for some reason or other, I have two mini bottles. And I get the first dog finished. I get him home. I put the second dog in the truck. And my head says, you know, the first dog got two mini bottles. By the time I finished the second dog and got him home, the 12-pack was gone. Now I'm in trouble because I got no booze for tomorrow's trip. So I go and I get another 12-pack. And I got errands to run. I got to go take care of my dad. I've got other things to do. And course of that traveling, the second 12-pack of mini bottles disappears. I get the third one. I started on that one. By the time I get home, I'm bouncing off the cabinets. My wife comes in and says, "You're drunk." And I said, "Yeah, but that's okay. I figured out I'm not an alcoholic." And she looks at me. And I said, "You don't understand. You haven't listened to these people. I haven't done the things that these people have done. I'm not one of them." She just starts crying. She uncontrollably. Because I have just ripped the last vestiges of hope out of her heart. Because as long as I was saying, "I'm an alcoholic," as long as I'm trying, there was hope. I've just taken that away from her. And she doesn't know what to do. And I don't want to hear it. And I go into a front bedroom and I close the door and I slump down. And it was at that moment in time. You know, the book says, and you read it. You know, we had to concede to our innermost selves that we were real alcoholics. And it was at that moment in time that I came to that realization. You see, it doesn't really matter what I say to you. You know, so I was sitting there sticking out my hand, Tom, alcoholic. You know, it doesn't matter what I say to you. It's what I say here. And until I reached that point, and that was my bottom, it was a point of loneliness that it talks about in the book. I came to the realization I'm an alcoholic, and I said, "So what? I can't do this anymore." And what I meant by that was I can't pick up another white chip. I can't lower myself again. I can't embarrass myself. I just can't do this. And after about 30 seconds of self-pity, and a voice came into my head, said, "Yes, you can. You're going to pick yourself up. You're going to dust yourself off. You're going to pick up a weight chip tonight, and you're going to go for it." And I know that was the second time that God talked to me. And the reason why I know that is because I'm not smart enough and brave enough to have that thought all by myself. I'm serious about that. I'm the type that, you know, will just wallow in my own self-pity. I love being in my own self-pity. You know, there's nothing better. So I got going, you know. I about 6 months into sobriety, I had to get another sponsor. And, you know, my sponsor at the time, he called me and said, "Tom, I need you to find another sponsor. I just don't have the time to devote to you. I've got too many things going on." He eventually went back out. But I said, "Well, Stephen, do you have any suggestions?" He says, "Well, you know the routine. Hit your knees tonight. Ask God for some direction. And he'll guide you where you need to go." So that night I got on my knees and I asked God for some direction in terms of picking a sponsor. And immediately this face comes into my head. And I went, "Oh, no. No, I don't think so. I'll sleep on this and try it again in the morning." And I tried again in the morning, and it was even faster. Even before I got the prayers out, it was, you know, right there. I said, "Okay, God." And this guy, I heard him in the rooms. I had been around him, and I thought he was an arrogant, you know, SOB. And I couldn't have been more wrong. He's serious about this thing. And he's exactly what I needed. And he launched me into action. He raised my hand. "You know, Tom will do it." Yeah. And I need that, because if you're going to wait for me to volunteer for something, it ain't going to happen. You know, even today, you know, I'm lazy to the core. So we got going. I got busy. He got me involved. I remember, you know, we were going to have a home group meeting, business meeting one night, and I got a call. My dad was being rushed to the hospital, and I told my sponsor, I said, I'm going to have to go to the hospital afterwards. And he said, "So you're not going to be around for the business meeting?" I said, "No, is that okay?" He goes, "Oh, no, that's fine." He said, "I just want to let you know that you're probably going to be picked as GSR. I said, "What if I stick around for the business meeting?" "You're probably going to be picked as GSR. Just say yes." And I didn't want to do that. And I got through that, and that led into, you know, doing, I got asked to be treasurer of the district and then vice chair of intergroup. And I got involved. I take meetings in the prison once a month. And I'm not telling you this because I'm this great guy. I don't really want to do these things. But the service has meant, I don't think we talk enough about service and its importance in these rooms. And so I try to take a minute or two to talk about how important it is to me. You know, the first night I came home from that first meeting, my wife asked me what, you know. And the only thing that I did that night that was right was somebody said, you know, "Get a big book and take it home and read it." I'm a voracious reader, so I can do that. I love to read. So I'm reading through this book, I'm sitting in an easy chair, and my wife's sitting over there in the sofa, and I come to page 60, and I said, "Hey, listen to this at 62, and I said, it says, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our trouble. And she says, "Tell me something I don't know." And I looked at her, and I said, "I can't believe you said that to me. I'm a very considerate person." She says, "Yeah, you are." I said, I've heard people say that Tom will give you the shirt off his back." She goes, "Oh, yeah, Tom, you do. But you expect something in return. And if you don't get something in return, it's hell to pay." And service has been important to me because it has demonstrated to me the importance of doing something without getting anything in return. And the rewards that I get from it, I just can't tabulate. You know, when I go to the prison, there's been so many times that in the beginning it was like, And see, I wanted to go into the men's prison, and I volunteered to go into a prison. And the chair up at the in our area, she came and said, "Your group is willing to go into prison? Yeah. Well, we need somebody to go Monday nights in the women's prison in Goochland." I'm going, "No, you know, you don't just walk into a prison and say, 'Here I am.' You got to work with the committee system and everything else. They kind of feed you in where they need you." And I didn't want to do that. And I, you know, but every time I came out of there, something happened. You know, I'd go in there dreading it, and I came out feeling better. And now I look forward to that. It's one of my favorite things to do. You know, my son, you know, I told you my son that he didn't want anything to do with me. He's one of my closest friends right now. In fact, whenever anything happens in his life of any importance, excitement, he calls me to tell me about it. I'm the first one he calls. My daughter, who was didn't want anything to do with me, stayed away, would take my calls. You know, 3 years ago, I got to walk her down the aisle to get married. I got to do it sober. I got to be present and participate in it. She called me a week before her wedding, and she was in tears. She was beside herself. The pressures from the wedding, the job, everything else was closing in on her, and she was just coming to pieces, and she picked up the phone and called her dad. Not her mom, her dad. And we talked for about an hour on the phone. By the time we finished, she was laughing. And she said, "Thanks, Dad. You always know what to say." I didn't say anything. I listened. Because you people have taught me that it's, you know, more times than not, it's more important to listen than to talk. I don't know if I'll get through this, but 4 weeks ago, Friday, 1 month ago, tomorrow, she presented me with my first grandson. And when he was born, my son-in-law came out and said, "Everything's fine, everything, you know." And they said, "You all could come back one at a time." And so everybody starts looking around, her mom, his mom, my wife. I said, "You all go on. I'll wait." And timing is everything, because what they got to do was they got to go in. It was in the labor room, and so my daughter was propped up in bed, and the nurse was working on my grandson, cleaning him up, checking his vitals, everything else. So they got to walk in, hug my daughter, watch the nurse work on my grandson, and then walk out. By the time I get in there, I hug my daughter, I go to watch my grandson. She's finishing up, she takes the stethoscope up, she wraps him up, she picks him up, says, "Who wants to be the first to hold him?" I back away to defer to my son-in-law and my daughter. My daughter says, "He does." You know, I don't get that without AA. None of that. You know, there's just so much in this that is just so wonderful. I didn't, you know, I got, my mom died before I got sober. I didn't know how to make amends to her. It troubled me that she died before I got sober. I had a long conversation with my sponsor about it, and he said, "Well, Tom, a lot of people write a letter, go to the gravesite, read it." And he says that, you know, that's fine. And if you want to do that, that's okay. More importantly is to be alert and aware and open to opportunities to be of help and to be of service to somebody. He says, particularly with respect to people that are kind of similar to your mom. The very next morning, I'm on a train going to D.C. on business from Richmond. And I take the business class train up because there's hardly anybody in there. I can unfold my work. I can work the whole way up, getting ready for my meetings up in D.C. And I've got all my stuff laid out in front of me, and I'm looking at things that the train hasn't pulled out, and I hear this voice. It says, "Excuse me, would you mind if I sat with you?" And I look up, and there's a woman that would have been about my mom's age. And my first reaction is to stand up. I want to stand up and go like this to the train because there isn't, you know, lady, pick a seat, you know. And I don't do that because the voice in my head is my sponsor saying, look for opportunities to be useful and helpful. And so I said, sure, sit down. She doesn't say anything. I'm not a conversationalist. But I say, well, where are you going today? You going to D.C.? No, I'm going to New York. Oh, really? You going to visit somebody? No, I live in New York. Oh, where are you coming from? Well, I'm coming from here. I've spent the last month with my daughter, son-in-law, and grandchildren. Really? Why don't you tell me how your trip? And for 2 hours, she talks virtually nonstop, and I listen to everything she has to say. And there's a glimmer in her eye. And before I know it, I'm pulling into D.C. And I just had one of the best 2 hours of my life. You know. But I would never have had that without AA, without what, you know, good sponsorship and the suggestion of what to be aware of. You know, I'd like to tell you that my life is golden and that there's, you know, just nothing out of the ordinary. It's just the best it could possibly be. And if I did, I'd be leaving you with a lie. Because the reality is that life happens. It continues to happen. And I'm going through some stuff right now in my life, my personal life. And I don't know how it's going to play out. There's not enough time to go into all the details. But one thing I do know is that I haven't had the need to take a drink. And this, you know, the book talks about it. This is a design for living, you know. And in this particular situation that's confronting me, it's a difficulty with my wife, and I don't know how this is going to play out, really. But, you know, that thing about selfishness and self-centeredness, you know, it follows. It says, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. And I'm able to look at this situation, and I know that I set this ball in motion. It wasn't today, it wasn't yesterday, it wasn't 2 weeks ago, it was quite some time ago. I don't like looking at that and seeing that. But the fact that I'm able to admit that is unbelievable. The fact that I'm able to tell her that she was, you know, that not only was she right, I was wrong, is unbelievable. And that may or may not, that's not good enough. I mean, this is a lifelong journey. Yeah, I've done a lot of damage. I did a lot of damage. She stuck with me for a long period of time. I did a lot of damage during that period of time. You know, it talks about the tornado. And I roared through a lot of people's lives, including hers. You know, the fact that I'm sober, the fact that I'm not drinking, the fact that I'm living a better life today isn't enough. You know, it's a long period of, it says it, it's a long period of reconstruction ahead. And I don't know how it's going to play out with her and me. It doesn't relieve me of that responsibility to do whatever I can to help her. And I will tell you, quite frankly, that fear has just consumed me. But with good sponsorship and in this program, you know, my sponsor, he looked at me and he said, Tom, you know, God is either going to take care of you or he's not. And I said, yeah, I know that. He says, so what is it? Is he going to take care of you or not? I said, he's going to take care of me. He says, okay. this isn't going to be easy. Life, who said life's going to be easy? But you've got a program here. So now I'm on my way through the steps again for the fourth time. You know, I've heard people say this is a journey. It's not a destination. Yeah. And that's certainly true with me. And I'm really at comfort and I'm at ease with this to a certain extent. Now, do I have my moments? Now, I told my sponsor, I said, I think I have a pretty solid handle on what it's like to be bipolar, because I go through moments of high and I go through moments of low. But one thing that I've always turned to is I've turned to God and asked Him for help. And you know what? He's always answered during this period of time. I have no reason to believe that He won't. Looking back at my life 10 years ago, where it was, and where I am today, that gives me hope that He's going to take care of me. He's going to lead me to something that He wants me to be at. I don't know where that's at. You know. But it's better than where it was 10 years ago. This is a remarkable program. I just can't say enough about it. I want to thank Sam and Billy again, Kelly for riding up with me, and more importantly, thank you all for having me here and allowing me to participate in your meeting. And I always close the same way that, you know, I hope there's something. If there's something that you heard tonight that you like, you know, that's on God. And if there's something you heard you don't like, that's on me, because God doesn't make mistakes. Thank you. Thank you.